creative interaction with wood ants for Waco River in a forest in 2014 and my subsequent work with meadow ants closer to home. The paper will detail the intertwined agential and ethical questions raised. And I'll draw on Haraway and Lucy Kimball, Patrick Curry and Lisa Jeffrat to touch on questions around co-production, rules, openness and responsibility. So on the first day of a short residency in a forest near Canterbury in 2014, I saw two wood ants' nests next to each other. And they were these large, extraordinary hump shapes, and I took some photographs. And on the second day, I stopped to look more closely at the nests, watching the ants swarming across the surface and swarming across the floor. And everywhere in this wood, they were visible. But in some places, were really thick with them near their nests. And many of them were carrying pine needles. And one...
Can we go back?
I just want to make it play, because it's a video, that one. Does anyone know?
Can you click on the screen? Does that?
No.
So, of each is video clips.
You hit escape and then see what options you have.
Is it? You have to imagine this, okay?
Yeah. Maybe you just need to click on the image.
It doesn't work, it clicks onto the next slide.
Does it work if you're not having the display mode on the screen?
It doesn't matter too much for this one, I'll fret about it a bit more later. Anyway. One small group of ants was carrying between them a caterpillar, and I watched as they hefted the creature that was many times their combined size up the hill of the nest. It got stuck on a twig, and there was ants either side stretching it like spaghetti, trying to sort of both tug it up the hill. And I was watching for a few minutes before they worked the puzzle out, and one of the ants walked around the bottom of the twig. So I was very struck by the teamwork and their problem solving, but most of all by the determination, because there was just no way that they were giving up. As I moved around the wood, I saw many more nests, all teeming with activity. Sorry, it's my ineptitude. And decided to try to make paintings together with these busy movers. I found a pair of similar sized nests on the side of a path and took a sheet of brown paper, mixed up a red watercolour. I placed the paper on the first nest and started to make painterly gestures mimicking the ants, quite flicky and fast and seeming to move in all directions at once. And the ants charged the paper furiously, chasing up the brush and over my feet and my trousers, and I could hear the mad tap, tap, tapping of their little feet on the paper. And it was unnerving, it was even quite scary. I know they can sting, but it was also just the sheer number of them and the intensity of their activity was really overwhelming and sort of militaristic or uncanny. Anyway, their feet left tiny, hundreds of tiny lines, marks that would be unachievable by human hand in the red paint. I worked as fast as I could, continually shaking the ants off the brush to try and stop them getting on my hand and then step back for a while to let the paint dry. Tried to shake myself free of the ants before lifting the edge of the paper and shaking it vigorously to get the ants off. So I repeated my actions with the nest on the right and was amazed how differently it reacted. The ants were really far more restrained, just 20 or so investigative, and they were really quite timid, more likely to run away from the moving brush than attack it. So it was this difference in response and what it might mean that made me really keen to experiment more. A few days later, I found an area of conifer wood which had several much larger nests, so maybe about 15 in this particular area, and considered my options. So I decided to change my gestures and not to attempt to emulate the activity of the ants, but to let them determine the mark making more. So I simply made splodges of wet watercolour at fairly regular intervals on the paper and in a kind of slightly humped shape to echo the nest form. So I puddled paint, and gravity made the wet watercolour run and the ants charged. And I chose six nests to compare, and I used different coloured paper for each nest. And one nest, whether this was the most aggressive, never slowed its attack on the paint. So in the resulting painting, it's not very good lighting here, but there's hardly any empty paper that survives. It becomes this really quite hallucinogenic effect. It's very, very detailed when you see it in reality with all the colours and marks being there. And other nests were far more cautious, or was that relaxed, or was it experienced? I don't know. With only a few ants getting onto the paper or seemed loath to stray into the wet patches. Ants communicate through a series of chemical signals that one alerts the nest mates to danger, and the second says where, and the third says how bad. And so obviously the messages being broadcast in these different nests were not of the same intensity or quality. So my working practices aim to be low impact and sensitive to the places and species that I work with, but not to leave either me or them as I found them. By one's presence, one is necessarily interfering with the natural processes and activities of one's subjects. But as an artist, interacting with rather than studying the natural world, this is intentional, indeed pivotal to my project. The work is about the meeting, or the interaction, to borrow Karen Barag's term, of ants and me. Lisa Jeff Bratt is a Swedish-born artist and a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and she's applied her research into unintentional collaborations, the exchange protocols and languages of the internet onto human exchanges with non-human animals, and teaches an undergraduate course on interspecies collaboration. Jeff Bratt posits that via the internet and contemporary technologies, humans are becoming increasingly involved in and know the benefits of collaborations that don't require an understanding of the other participants' agenda or intention, and that these can serve as protocols for ethical collaborations with non-humans. For my own work, the term I prefer is co-production, which I think better describes the emphasis on shared agency contained in the event or the action or the object without implying that we share our intention. So steering through or around the word collaboration in my work is really still a very live issue. I aim to foreground the ant's agentic actions within the making of the work, and to challenge the anthropocentric hierarchies which suggest that agency rests on a creature's level of planning and rational decision making. I see the kinds of forward thinking and purposive activity which Owen Cloke and Paul Jones claimed for trees in their 2000 book Tree Cultures would certainly apply to an ant, and in addition, their complex collaborative societal structures allow them a high degree of psychological notions of plan, intention, evidence, and skill. That's just quoting Mele in Cloak and Jones, and that's well documented. There's lots of BBC Nature documentaries which show that. One thing that I want to, I suppose, emphasise is that I didn't just borrow the ants' bodies to make interesting lines. It had the idea to make the work at all by watching them. So the ants are pivotal to the work's conception and dictate the materiality to a large extent. So to move on to the sort of more nitty-gritty of the ethical problems I encountered, I use non-toxic watercolours on paper removed when dry, so not particularly disturbing to the nest as a whole over the longer term, but a few ants did drown in the paint. More than once, a nestmate seemed to try to drag a struggling ant out of a wet patch, which looked somewhat heroic and made me feel emotionally somewhat queasy. A few particularly aggressive individuals really clenched onto my paintbrush with such force I just couldn't shake them off, and they'd can lift 100 times their body weight, and ultimately some of those also died. So what I want to do in the context of this conference is ask myself an awkward question. Why was it okay for some ants to die? And I don't mean to suggest I wasn't bothered. Some reflection and research has emerged from my troubledness. But in the active moment, it was okay enough, at least, that I didn't stop. And I think this is because of certain preconceptions that I have around ants. So I'm going to list some of these. I wouldn't say I wholeheartedly believe them all, but that they were active at the time in some way for me. Number one, there are billions upon billions of ants, and they're very small. I was necessarily treading on them every time I walked anywhere in that forest, but particularly in the vicinity of their nests. So surely more died as a result of my normal activity than when I was engaged directly with them. Number two, ants are not in any real sense individuals. They do not see themselves as individuals. So a few more or less doesn't really count. Three, they're cold-blooded, machinic, not sentient, in the same sense that a mammal or a bird is. Do they even have a brain? Four, they're indifferent to the suffering of others. I don't think that they notice it because they don't have any suffering themselves, let alone a capacity for empathy. Five, they're aggressive and sting, so they incite dislike. And six, ants are treated as a pest in other contexts. People put powder down to kill whole nests of them. So this image is a Google search of the word ant nests, and over half the entries are about killing. So what this shows is that despite my best artistic and philosophical intentions, my self-interest has got the upper hand, and my intuitive or conditioned hierarchies of value are deeply entrenched. Donna Haraway suggests in her charged chapter on sharing the suffering of lab animals that to quote, is a misstep to separate the world's beings into those who may be killed and those who may not, and it is a misstep to pretend to live outside killing. The sentence is double edges. It makes my killing wrong, and my being a killer completely ordinary. And this sharply dividing meaning mirrors one I see as active between what one might think of as the ethics of the everyday and the kind of ethical inquiry that might take place at an academic conference like this one. Killing takes place at astronomical levels in modern food production. Patrick Curry, writing in 2011, cites that between 45 and 50 billion farm animals are slaughtered for food worldwide, and most of these within factory farm conditions. But one of the touchstones for my practice is that my knowledge and my thinking evolves to a great extent through making my work. So it has to come from a place of reasonable honesty about who I am, how I live, and what I bring to the conversation. And obviously that position is always hopefully growing, changing. Let's see if I can get this to work.
Media not found.
It's a shame.
Put it up.
Put it up.
The mouse.
Yeah, it's still on the button.
Try to click there.
Not doing anything.
No.
Media
not
found.
So the link is broken.
Mm. Oh, I know why. It's because I moved it.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I just put it on the desktop to facilitate finding it. Okay, I give up. Sorry. It's me making the painting with the ants. Okay.
Well, you can close that, and if you put it on the desktop, just click on the
desktop
video and you put it on the desktop.
Yeah. No, I didn't put the film on the desktop, I put the PowerPoint on the desktop. I've got the whole film somewhere, but I've saved a little clip. Maybe I can find it. Do you want me to find it?
Well,
I don't know how much. I mean, you've got. We'd like to hear what you have to say as well.
Let's have a look. There we go. Good. Okay, so this brings up a very different set of ethical implications than following a set of predetermined rules, whether they're my own rules or those set down by a university ethics committee or the like. Because in that latter instance, where does all the awkward, live, risky, up against it decision-making take place? Where is the thought-provoking activity? And how does what I do relate to that ordinary, everyday world? Does art not need to have a foot in both camps to remain relevant? As Haraway remarks later, bioethics acts as a regulatory discourse after all the really interesting generative action is over. Whilst working with and inevitably killing these ants, I was keenly aware of myself then and our asymmetric interaction. It was bracing, awkward, and I think worthwhile. As artist Mark Dion puts it in his ethical manifesto, I must take responsibility for these animals' welfare and face up to those deaths, which is not necessarily the same, though it could be, as not making the work. There cannot be an okay number of ants to die in any quantifiable way, and yet to put insect deaths in the service of art in too different a register of ethical expectation than those created haphazardly might leave one too constrained to create lively, responsive work. Conversely, if art is about bringing things to full attention through a process of noticing, amplifying and mediating, then it is much the ethics of the relationship that the artwork brings into focus as the aesthetic, which means that artists need to be prepared to have an enhanced level of ethical responsibility while working. When Lucy Kimball planned her rat-evaluated artwork in 2005, she sketched a complex series of clear tunnels with junctions acting as points of choice for rats as they move through the work, each labelled according to her imagined rattish evaluation of the work at that point, exploitative, beautiful, not fully resolved. The piece was never made. Kimball slowly realised she couldn't do it, even though she wanted to, for a mixture of practical and ethical reasons. Her thinking had evolved considerably through her practice research and had left her plans behind. And it's particularly the language that she uses to describe this process that I find enlightening. So to quote her, she had agreed to let me try to train them aesthetically. Neither of us knew was clear what that meant. And again, I was just doing a thing and seeing what it was like. And that moves you forward, not the design, not the conceptualisation of it. They're both cited in Baker's artist animal. What I find both refreshing and experientially familiar in these descriptions is Kimball's determined admittance of not knowing, and thus her openness and her attentiveness to what actually happens and what that changes. Being in active and listening relation to the non-human and learning to do this better then becomes both method and result. On reading Patrick Curry's Ecological Ethics, I was struck particularly by a couple of ideas pithily put by Aldo Leopold, namely to think like a mountain, and Val Plumwood, who stated that solidarity is the most fundamental of political relationships. So Leopold's phrase, initially written in regard to the disastrous effect of dewarfing the North American mountains that he loved, made me think struck me as a way to approach or aim to approach my wider woodland project, which sort of takes into account more of the whole kind of ecosystem near my home. And Plumwood's made me feel a bit ashamed. I want to have a hands-on, semi-instrumentalised relationship to my woods, the ones that I work with a lot, and one that mirrors how earlier peoples might have approached their territories, not standing outside of them as a sort of patriarchal protector or as a distant admirer, but being in amongst taking and giving. And I need to keep thinking about that giving and how that manifests. Last month I tried to make a new series of paintings with ants. And to address some of the ethical issues by rethinking my material approach, the ants I work with this time are very different morphologically, being a meadow species that made small earth humps rather than the large pine needle covered mounds. I think they were Lasius niger, but I haven't had that verified by an expert. They were much smaller and lighter and completely black. Paper as a substrate wouldn't do, as the humps were too tiny and they had lots of grass growing up through them. So after various experiments, I settled on using flint stones that were gathered higher up the hill and primed with gesso. And instead of paint, I used blackberry juice so that the ants could eat it if they wanted. And I painted this on in these kind of organic geometric patterns that responded to the shapes of the flints but would contrast with the more random or, you know, different lines that the ants would make. So the resulting work is something of a compromise aesthetically. These tiny ants barely made any mark on the lines of the juice. Their feet were so small and they were so light that their activity registered really more as a blur to my own lines than very many lines of their own, unless you've got a magnifying glass. unless they actually got very wet and drooped their abdomens into the juice. But that happened far less often than with the wood ants, because the juice didn't pool due to the lack of flat surfaces. But that point was key to the non-killing. It was the pooling that had drowned the previous ants. And just sort of a postscript, strangely or maybe predictably, in evaluating the ethical development my research had elicited in me, all of my questioning of those preconceptions and learning more about ants, I discovered that when I was actually in the field, actively pursuing making work with the adrenaline running, it was really quite difficult to place the welfare of an individual ant above getting a good result for the work. So while I was really careful not to kill them, I found myself jiggling the flintstones or lifting some ants onto the stones with flower stems because they weren't, they weren't doing very much, or they just were ignoring it, and I was like, oh, I want you to draw. Obviously that was disturbing to these little, cold-blooded, sentient, intelligent